Taxation is theft.
Please, at least leave us alone in our living room.
My job is to find the truth.
Double the taxes.
I'm a human being. God damn it. My life has value.
Triple the taxes.
This is an IRS agent's dream.
If you think that the Capitol will ever treat us fairly, you are lying to yourself.
Beautiful, lovely taxes.
Sorry, but I don't do taxes.
Did you see the memo about this?
The government is a greedy piglet.
Just leave us alone.
Do you know what Ralph just said?
The roads.
You boys like Mexico?
Hello, happy Monday. Welcome back. Taxation is theft. And today's going to be really awesome. I have Tim Moen, who is the Canadian Libertarian Party leader, which is an interesting position because, as it turns out, they run things a little bit differently than we do in the U.S. So, Tim, welcome. How's it going?
Hey, it's going fantastic. I'm just sitting here enjoying my quarantine whiskey and now waiting for this all to blow over. Sure, we'll be fine.
Awesome. So I guess this is really interesting to me just because, you know, there's it shows that the Libertarian Party is it's not strictly unified. We have Libertarian parties all over the world and they're all a little bit different. So in the U.S., we have the chair who's like the guy who makes, I guess he's like the CEO. And then you have a presidential candidate. And you're telling me that the way that's structured is a little bit different. How is that?
Yeah, well, it's more like, if Sarwark was also your presidential candidate by default, by being the chair or something like that. So I share a lot of the duties that your chair would probably share in terms of, I have certain, decision-making authority within the party, within, the legal structure from Elections Canada and the way our party is structured. But I also run for office and, if our party wins, and forms government, then I would be expected to be prime minister. We don't really vote directly for our prime minister here in Canada the way you guys would vote for your president. It's whichever party. Our prime minister is technically chosen by the Queen through the Governor General, but she usually chooses, the Queen usually chooses the leader of the winning party to be the prime minister. And so, we become so Americanized here by following, we follow American politics on our TV probably more than we even follow our own politics.
Wow.
And so people, we always go to the ballot box and talk like we're going to elect our prime minister the way you would talk about electing your president, even though technically it doesn't work that way. But, in terms of the party structure, I'm the leader, so I'm basically the public face of the party. I'm out there campaigning. I'm putting out the platform. I'm endorsing candidates and different things like that. We also have a president who is more operational. So our president looks after the back end of the party, make sure all the I's are dotted, the T's are crossed, does a lot of the logistical support for candidates and that sort of thing. So, it's a little bit different, I guess, than the way you folks are used to in the U.S.
Interesting. And it sounds like a lot of that is because the political system is different, because you wouldn't have, like you said, you don't vote directly on somebody. So you would have to basically have your candidate always elected someone in the party.
And so we don't have primaries the way you guys do down there. We don't have like a primary season where all the parties are trying to choose who their guy is going to be to run for the highest office. We vote for my position at our regular convention. So every convention, just like Sarwark or any of the other positions in your party that you vote for at your convention, I run. And if I win, that means, I'm basically expected to carry the banner and be the public face of the party going into the next election and in between elections and all points in between.
Awesome. So when people are looking at these elections, are they, what does this look like? Are there debates between the leaders of the different parties?
Yeah, we have a national debate every year, and we have so many parties in Canada, it's kind of hard to get on that debate stage. I think this past election we had four leaders up there, four or five leaders. And, you know, they have a kind of a changing goalpost about who they're going to let on right. that stage. But, you know, the four main parties are the Conservative Party, the Liberal Party, the New Democratic Party, which is kind of like a socialist party, and then the Green Party. And those are usually the four candidates you see on that stage. But there's a lot more parties than that in Canada. It because it is so easy to get on the ballot. You know, I understand ballot access is an issue right. in the U.S. where you have to work really hard to get that. I mean, here, for one of our candidates to get on the ballot, all they need is basically my endorsement and 100 signatures in the riding, and they're on the ballot.
Wow. And well, and that's, of course, for the lower positions.
That's just to run as a candidate for a member of parliament, which I guess would be equivalent to like a congressman maybe or something like that.
Right.
If you want to find
something. And what about like some of your other elections, like mayor? Do you have like county commissioner type?
Yeah, we have those, but those we don't have parties when it comes to municipal politics. There aren't. I have never heard of anyone having any kind of party affiliation.
Interesting.
Yeah, they're just run as a person, as an independent. There's no party affiliations for that. You know, provincially we have parties, but the provincial parties are separate from the federal parties. So, you know, in Alberta, for example, we have a Conservative Party, but their name is the United Conservative Party, where the federal party's name is the Conservative Party of Canada. So there's no. I mean, they probably share the same membership, or many of the same members, you know, are belong to both parties, but they're not in any way affiliated officially. If that makes any sense.
Interesting.
Yeah. And so we have a few provincial libertarian parties. While we have two, Ontario and British Columbia, have libertarian parties, but they are governed and they're not officially affiliated with us. You know, because provincial parties and federal parties are separate here in Canada.
Right. So how does that work out? Are people usually pretty happy with the election results? Or like here, there's a lot of people who are just like, yeah, the system's broken. We need to change the whole yeah. voting system and everything else.
Yeah, we definitely have a lot of that. I mean, you know, after this last election with the Liberal government and Trudeau winning, Western Canada was just up in arms. You know, we saw a huge surge of separatist sentiment, let's say, and a lot of people talking about Wexit, right? The Western Canada should separate from the rest of Canada. There's nothing in it for us. It's particularly, you know, a hot topic here in Canada because in the West, you know, our constitution is a shit show. Sorry, am I allowed to use bad
yeah,
words?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, cool. It's a shit show in that we don't have a clear constitution the way you guys do with, you know, that preamble of we hold these truths to be self-evident that all men are created equal and you know, these amendments that are pretty clear. We have this British North American Act, and then we have a Constitution Act, and then we have the Charter of Rights and Freedoms, which were added in not in the 80s, but are kind of wishy-washy. Our constitution is kind of a framework for provincial transfers, monetary transfers. And so some provinces get, so we pay our income tax to the federal government, and then the federal government will dish out a bunch of that money to have-not provinces. So provinces like Quebec, for example, get a lot of Alberta taxpayers' money. And so there's a lot of animosity right now because there's continually wealth transfer from Albertans to Quebec, the province of Quebec, and yet Quebec continually blocks our pipelines that we're trying to build to get to market. So they'll import all the Saudi oil, but then they block our pipelines. We produce a lot of oil here. We're kind of like the Texas of Canada. And, you know, nobody wants our oil in our own country. But yet they take all our money that we make from producing this stuff, but they won't let us sell it. They block our pipelines and stuff.
Right.
So there's a lot of animosity. You know, the West feels like it's getting a bad shake and everything's unfair. And so, you know, there's a lot of that kind of sentiment in Canada right now.
Interesting. That stuff always fascinates me because there's like, you know, it's you know, you can look at states and you can look at countries and their, you know, trade imbalances and everything. But I always find it fascinating that, you know, if you change it to something local, like, you know, if you have one city that's got more wealth than another city, should you steal from one city and give to the other city?
Right.
And it's like, you know, at what point does it become insane when you, when one person lives next to another person and that person makes a little bit more?
Yeah. I use that analogy all the time, you know, and when it comes to even things like trade or division of labor, or why are we importing this particular product from that country while we, you know, we'll keep our jobs here. I mean, you can make that same argument to in your hometown or in your neighborhood or in your home. Like, why are we trading with anyone outside this home? Why aren't we making it right here?
Right.
You know, it's the same argument, but yeah.
Interesting. All right. So I want to talk a little bit about what's going on with current events. Obviously, you've got your lockdown whiskey. What's it like up there? Is, you know, how locked down are you? Is this voluntary? Is the government threatening people with citations and arrests and fines? What's it look like?
Yeah. In different provinces, they're definitely threatening citations and fines. I mean, all our restaurants are shut down. That's not voluntary. That's mandatory. You know, that we're basically only allowed to go to the grocery stores. You know, life is kind of sucks right now. A lot of people have lost their job and are trying to figure out how to pay rent and how to pay mortgage and that sort of thing. Luckily, you know, and our government has classified essential workers versus non-essential workers. So if you're an essential, you're okay. If you're a non-essential person, you're not doing so well right now. Luckily, I'm an essential because I'm a firefighter, paramedic, and so they expect me to go out there and confront this thing head on. You know, Joe, comic book store owner or the theater guy, I guess they're non-essential,
right?
As far as the government's concerned, so they've kind of created this two-class system almost.
Right. Yeah. And it's, you know, it's interesting to see that here in the U.S. because we've kind of already had that system going for a while where you've got, you know, the Bernie Sanders out there telling everybody, you know, we need to steal from the rich. So you create this rich poor
right
class fight. And now it's like it's almost like they're taking the you know, I guess the middle class or the non-elites, everybody who's not a government elite. And they're figuring out how to divide those people in half. And
yeah.
It's really kind of shady. So this is one thing that always comes up when I see this is like, you know, everyone's been talking about how the economy's been doing so well, and this really proves like, no, it hasn't been, because ultimately nobody, like, we shouldn't have to depend on, and I know this sounds socialist when people first hear it, we shouldn't have to depend on our jobs, but if we owned our property and we were a lot closer to our food production and water sources and everything else, there really wouldn't be that big of a need for jobs. And you know, we'd have money saved.
Yeah.
We'd work, you know, to improve our lives, not to just stay alive. And that's it's, you know.
Well, yeah. I mean, this thing has really highlighted how fragile our system is, right? You know, the consumer debt, like never mind political debt or government debt, just consumer debt alone. I don't know what it's like in the States, but in Canada, it's astronomical. You know, a lot of Canadians, the majority of them are living paycheck to paycheck, don't Yep. have a lot saved up. Now, why is it that that's the case? Well, it's because of government policy over the last, 100 years, really. I mean, we can probably pinpoint it back to the start of the first central bank here in Canada, and then the implementation of a temporary income tax in 1917 that we're still paying, and that's still grown gargantuan in size. So, you know, half our income is stolen right off the top by government, and then the central bank inflates our currency, artificially suppresses interest rates, and this incentivizes people to spend rather than save. And so I have to wonder how robust we would be if the government wasn't stealing our money all the time, and if we actually got some kind of return on savings, right? Like in a proper economy with a market-based interest rates. And so now, yeah, of course, we're living paycheck to paycheck. And what does the government do to help us through this crisis? Well, at the same time, they shut us down and stop us from producing any value or living our life. They rapidly inflate the money supply like we've never seen before, I don't think. And at the same time, they drop the interest rates. So they're doubling down on this Keynesian theory that has made us so fragile, and they're making us even more fragile right now. So it's unbelievable what's going on. I'm writing an article right now. I hope to have it published soon. That goes through a lot of this, but you know, I make the argument in this article that because I hear regularly people telling me you can't compare this to the flu. This is not the flu. It's far worse than the flu, and I agree that it probably is far worse than the flu. But my challenge to these people is, what do you think we should be doing right now to save lives from corona that we should not be doing during seasonal flu, during the regular seasonal flu season? Because surely all the things that we're doing right now, if you believe that they're preventing corona deaths, would also prevent tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of flu deaths during a regular year. And that's the point of this article is like, what are we doing now? What we should be doing is exactly what we should be doing during flu season.
Right.
Because lives are at stake. And so, you know, I make the case that, look, here's some good things we should be doing. We should be keeping our kids home from school. Obviously they should never go to public school again. Those are just giant cesspools. I mean, this is going to be seen if your kids are home now, this is going to be the best memories they have of their entire school career, right? That yeah. They're home with the people that they love. They get to spend time with the people that care most about them in the world, that they care most about. They're learning everything that they would learn in school anyways right now, presumably. So what will you tell your kids about sending them back to public schools? Are you going to tell them that they need to go there to be socialized? I mean, with a bunch of other dysfunctional, imprisoned, indoctrinated dysfunctional kids. I mean, is that proper socialization? Are you going to tell them that they're going to need to be, they need to go there to get a proper education, when a lot of the parents are telling me that they're able to whip off a whole semester's worth of schooling in like a couple of weeks? I mean, what are they doing in school the rest of the time?
Right.
So I mean, that's one thing. We now know that sending kids to public school kills people, right? So that's what they're telling us. That's why they have the school shut down, presumably. So we can end that right now. And then other things like, there's a few good things coming out of this, germ awareness, how pathogens spread. That's fantastic. These are all things that as a paramedic, I've been practicing for 20, 25 years. I don't walk through someone's cough cloud. I steer clear of people that are coughing. If I'm coughing or if I'm feeling sick, I don't go to work. I don't expose people to those pathogens because I just think that's a nasty thing to do. So these are some good things I think that are emerging, and maybe will become the norm that we should, maybe be a bit more considerate of others so as not to spread the virus. But, this whole idea that we need to have a life stoppage because science says so, someone said, someone on my Facebook was making fun of Southerners in the U.S. They put up a heat map that showed where people were not self-isolating. And of course, it was all the Southern states, and then compared that to the Northern states where they imposed more of a lockdown because they're following science, and the South just doesn't do science. And I said, well, I'm pretty sure science says that you can't make any money sitting on your couch. I think that's a scientific fact. So maybe it's the South that's following science right now. And, my point was and then I asked them, well, what does science say about me personally? Should I be going to work or shouldn't I? I'm going right there into the thick of this horrible threat you're telling me is going to kill me. And so should the science say I should go to work or not? Well, of course, right. Science has nothing to say about this because this is a personal decision I have to make. I have to weigh the risk of unemployment with the risk that this virus causes me. And right now I choose to go to work because the risk of unemployment and taking my life, having my life take that hit is far worse to me than this minor threat of a virus that I see. And eventually that calculation will change when I get older, when I'm, 80 and I have a full pension and, I've got a whole bunch of comorbidities and that sort of thing. Yeah. I'm probably going to quit my job at that point and stay home and protect and actually pay someone to protect me from pathogens in a nursing home or something like that and change my diaper at the same time And by the way, they're going to be liable if they ever get me sick. I'm going to sue them, or my family's going to sue them for all they're worth, because they have a duty to me. But right now, I should be free to make those decisions. And why shouldn't everyone else be free to make those decisions? If I get sick, it's no one else's fault. It's not your fault, Dan, for leaving your house and going outside and taking a stretch or going for a grocery run. You're not the one that killed me. I killed myself by going out and exposing myself to risk. So people need to be able to take their own risks and accept the consequence of that. And that's the only way we're going to get through that. And by the way, that should be in place. That should be the common theme for our whole life. That should not be suspended just because risk is a little bit higher now than it normally is.
Right. Yeah. I mean, that's the thing. When you step outside of your house, even not stepping outside of your house, there are risks, and those risks are always going to be there. And some of those risks are going to be animals, weather, natural disasters. Some of them are going to be human beings. That's one way to look at it. And then, you know, you have government coming in and saying, we're going to protect you from all those things by forcing you to protect yourself, because we don't think you're capable of protecting yourself. But by the way, we're going to take away your means of living. I mean, I've talked to several people already who are already going through depression, anxiety, all these other things from being in their house for so long. How many suicides are going to happen as a result of this? How many people are going to literally starve to death? And I know people in other countries that, you know, you think we're living, you know, paycheck to paycheck. These are people who are, you know, they work, they bring that money home and they buy food with it, and that's their day. It's not taking into consideration. And this is what government always does, right? It always tries to say, okay, we have this one plan. It'll work for most people. It's probably going to totally screw other people up. But they don't care. There's no exceptions for people like, wait, no, I have to work, or else, you know, I have no other way to pay. It's really, you know, they don't take into consideration any of that. And that's always the unintended consequences.
Yeah. And in Canada here, we have this meme going around that, that says, is there a tax that we can use to stop this virus? Right. Because in Canada here, we have a carbon tax. In fact, our government has just increased the carbon tax by 50% while this virus is going on, and voted themselves a pay raise and all this other thing. While this crisis is happening, it's ridiculous. But you know, the point is that obviously a tax isn't going to stop this. But if you think about it, what the government is doing right now is going to have to be paid for by a tax one way or the other. They're either going to have to steal the money from us in the future to pay for all the spending they're doing right now to cover the lack of production, or they're going to inflate our money supply and steal it from our buying power. One way or another, the government's stealing money from us, taxing us, and that is being portrayed as the cure here. And you mark my words, you are naive as hell if you think that the government or all the people that also support a carbon tax because it'll avert climate catastrophe won't trot this out as a huge resounding success. And they'll talk about the millions of people that would have died had we not imposed these draconian measures and something equivalent to a UBI and all these other things. All these draconian government measures are going to be trotted out as, see, this fixed coronavirus, and it can fix the climate catastrophe as well. So be ready for that.
Yeah, I mean, that's a really good point, because a lot of people are, you know, we see crazy numbers, we see crazy projections. People are going to say, if it weren't for the lockdown, 100 million people would have died. But there's no way of ever proving that. And of course, there's never any way of disproving it either. But, you're absolutely right. They're going to use that as a justification to say, see, I mean, I already see people doing it now. If we weren't the numbers aren't that high now, but if we weren't doing the lockdown, this is interesting too, because there's, like you said about the regular flu, that happens to a lot of people. How many people die every day from heart attacks? From obesity? And that's not something that you, like, you go out and you buy something from the grocery store and because someone else touched it, you got obese. No, that's because of your own decisions. And what tens of thousands of people die from that every day. And what are we doing about that? Should we force people? Should we remove those foods that we like from the shelves? Should we, force people to go to a government scale every week and you know, get their ration of food and say, oh, you're not getting any because you're too heavy.
I'm sure Michael Bloomberg would say yes, that all should happen.
Yeah, that's right, because he's the sugar tax guy. It's like that sounds absolutely absurd.
That kind of stuff is trotted out in Canada here all the time because we have socialized medicine, and so people are like, well, I shouldn't have to pay for fatty's heart attack and this and that, right? That's common excuse. So yeah, for sure, be prepared for that kind of thing. And I suspect that I wouldn't be surprised to see Trump implement some sort of Medicare for all out of this. It seems to me that one thing I noticed in the States is that, if Obama had rolled out this stimulus package, the Republicans would be up in arms. They would be apoplectic right now. But because Trump did it and he's a Republican, they can get away with it, right? Same with Obama. Obama, if it had been Bush or Trump bombing and creating kill lists and doing all the things that Obama did with his war hawk policies, that the left would be up in arms. But because Obama did it, they're okay with it. So this is how we get bipartisan support for totalitarianism, basically. Hmm. Right. It's troubling times, and I don't see enough people pushing back against this lockdown. I'm hoping that in a month or two, people will. I see it a little bit already. People going like, what the hell is going on here? Like, what do we really need to? Do I really need to ruin my life to save someone in an old folks home that should be protected anyways? Who are we protecting here? Well, the people you're protecting are people just like you and me who are going outside. Well, if they're willing to go outside and accept the risk, then that's their responsibility. Why am I being held responsible for them? I'm not holding anyone responsible for me getting sick if I go to work. That's on me. This is a trolley problem where we're expected to believe that, if we don't pull this lever, if we pull the lever, 100,000 people are going to die instead of 1 million or something like that. But it fails to take into account that all these people can move right off the track. They can just step off the track. Right. They don't have to get hit at all. They can step off the track. But what we can't step off the track of is government coercion and intervention.
Right. And, this is something I saw this headline of an article that said, a city was upset that their red light cameras were giving out fewer tickets and their revenue was down. And of course, because nobody's on the road, right? And I'm thinking, like, that's really interesting that they would write that article and they wouldn't say something like automobile-related fatalities are down.
Right, right.
Like, so it's not really about safety at all. It's all about money. And, you talk about risk, and it's like, okay, if I walk outside of my house in a city like New York or Los Angeles where, or Chicago where they're really locked down and you've got police out there giving out citations, what's your real risk? Is your real risk catching the virus or getting a citation from a police officer? And most of these officers, they're not wearing gloves or masks or anything. They're not really observing a 6-foot rule. They don't seem to be too concerned about this risk either. Not to say that that's smart. These are kind of the thugs that are out there, collecting revenue, whatever way possible.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And by the way, the most vulnerable people, that are elderly, our seniors, guys like my father, they are reliant on their retirement funds being there. And right now their retirement funds are getting wiped out. So how is it, all this loss of wealth that we're experiencing right now with people that have saved their whole lives, relying on continued production, how is this for their health when they can't afford the same type of health care? They can't afford the same type of hygienic conditions. They can't afford nutrient dense food, healthy food anymore. And how is this going to be for their morbidity and mortality rate? I mean, the amount of harm that the government is doing here to human life is unbelievable.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean that's a really interesting point. You mentioned some sort of UBI. Is there a plan in place, or is there something already going on to that effect?
No, but I mean we're all the UBI proponents are coming out in spades now, right? They're pushing for this, and essentially what the government, you know, I understand that the in the U.S. it's similar to Canada. People that are out of work are basically getting straight up money. You know, they're not discriminating against, like there's no real screening process like there would be for welfare or anything like that. It's just like, if you lost your job, you're getting money. If you're in hardship, you're, you know, so it's not hard to see how easy it will be for them to make the case for UBI. If there's any, you know, the people that are getting this government check, you think they're going to want that to stop?
I mean, right.
You know, I just suspect. So
yeah, why,
you know,
go back to work?
Months, when, yeah. For the next few months, what we're seeing is basically a UBI experiment writ large.
Wow.
In Canada and the U.S. It's what it looks like to me anyways.
So what's the I actually have a neighbor down here. I'm in Mexico right now. And one of my neighbors is from Canada. And I guess he got a call from the embassy down here saying, go back. So he hopped on a plane that same day and went up there. What's the situation with travel and borders and everything?
Yeah, I mean, it's the same. You know, my son was going to school in the U.S. in Ohio, and, you know, he was basically told to come home too. Canadians can come home right now, but they're limiting travel in and out to essential, and I'm not sure how they're defining essential travel. I don't know what the thing is, but yeah, the borders are essentially locked down to tourists and people sightseeing and that sort of thing. I don't know the details exactly what they're enforcing and what they're not, but it's troubling.
Right. Yeah, and that's the thing, because a lot of this kind of, you know, it came out of nowhere. So, you know, like government's traditional one size fits all plans, you know, to just say, you know, like you said, traditional or what'd you call it? Essential or non-essential. You know, when you have a border that's locked down and a truck comes and you've got someone who's working the border and they just want to be a jerk and they say, oh yeah, no, you're not considered essential. What is the rule? Was the rule made to be broad? Was it like very specific? Did they not take into consideration something that they really should have?
I think what they're doing is applying broad strokes and then trying to figure out the details as they go. I don't think anyone really has a plan or knows what they're doing. They're just kind of doing what they think makes sense in the moment. And they're doing it because citizens are demanding it. They're demanding that government take action. You know, everyone wants the border shut because they're worried about the virus coming in. And you know, they're using this as political football too. I understand Donald Trump put an order on 3M stopping mask shipments to Canada.
Yeah.
You know, so here we are, Canada, Canadian company is the one supplier, from what I understand, of this special kind of pulp used to make these masks. But now we can't get the product here. And, you know, I could imagine that border control agents are being asked to check out any trucks that might be carrying goods out of the country that we need here in the country or something like that. Right. So I can just imagine the repercussions of something like that on trade and business. But
right. Yeah. And that was interesting because there was I saw this guy doing an interview on one of the mainstream channels. And he was basically saying that 3M, as a representative of the United States, he was trying to contact one of 3M's distributors and buy masks, and they were refusing to sell to him because they were already sold out. And he said, okay, put us on a list or something, and they refused. And I thought that was really strange because, you know, to any, you know, capitalist corporation, you would think, okay, let them pay more, ask them for more money. And, you know, and it seemed like, you know, some sort of propaganda. And now, of course, we're, you know, now they're just ordering them around and saying, you know, ship them here. There's a lot of really interesting stuff going on. And, you know, this all comes from, you know, after a period where we've got, we had, I guess there were a lot of masks and tests and everything that were sitting on docks in the US that weren't FDA approved, so people weren't allowed to use them. And so, you know, it's like, wait a minute, you guys are, you know, first you're preventing us from having access. And now that you realize you want something, you want to go, you know, use some sort of force to get it. Instead of, you know, if you would have just gotten out of the way before, things would have gone, shelves would have restocked and we'd probably have a lot of these products places and, you know, without having to fight.
Well, what we're seeing is a lot of, you know, in some cases we're seeing, the government removing restrictions, right? Like, you know, I understand that some of these masks now are just going to be allowed in, that people are going to be able to use. The FDA has gotten out of the way of using chloroquine and some of these other substances that haven't been proven yet. You know, they're letting healthcare workers cross borders despite not being licensed or whatever in a particular jurisdiction. So they're doing all these things right now because it'll save lives. And again, the point in my article is, if this is saving lives now, why don't we do this all the time? It will save lives all the time, right? You know, in Canada, we have a very brittle healthcare system. It's very fragile. It's a single point of failure. You know, I have two daughters that are paramedics as well, and they're underemployed right now. The only place that they can work for is the government, essentially the single health service here. And they're not able to find work, even though there's supposedly our healthcare system's getting ready to be totally overwhelmed.
Right.
Well, I mean, they could start a community paramedic business where they were going to seniors places where they have mobility issues, and they could be doing health checks on them and working on care plans and writing prescriptions and making sure that they don't get this virus and keeping them healthy through all this. But they're not allowed to. They're prohibited by law from working for anyone but the government. And so, you know, and this isn't, you know, in Alberta, because of the oil prices and just all the federal government fuckery, we have a lot of unemployed people because in the oil industry right now, a lot of them are medics who can't find work. And so we have all these healthcare personnel, and this has to be the case across Canada, all sorts of unemployed or underemployed healthcare professionals that could be put to work right now if they were allowed to be entrepreneurs and go out there and start selling services to people who wanted them and are willing to pay for them. That would dramatically increase our healthcare capacity right now. So why aren't we doing it? Why shouldn't we be doing that in perpetuity? In Canada, it has to do with ideological reasons. Canadians love their socialist medical system. In the US, I suspect it has more to do with cronyist reasons, because you need that permission slip from the government and only the cronies are getting it. So I think this is a big opportunity for libertarians to point out how healthcare freedom can really help people, because all the bottlenecks that we're seeing here have to do with government regulation and prohibition. That's the bottleneck. It's, you know, these masks need FDA approval. Why? I'm a medical professional. Should my choice be an FDA approved mask or nothing? Right now, that's my choice. You know, Ontario has 1 week supply of masks left for its healthcare workers. What are they going to do after that? Is it going to be nothing? Or they're just going to have to hold their breath when they go in and deal with the patient? You know, wear a burqa? Right. What's the plan here?
Yeah, no, that's really interesting. And this is, I've been talking a lot about the, you know, this whole idea of flattening the curve so that it's not so high, and it's under the line of, the healthcare system's capacity. And it's like, why aren't we just raising that line? Because
raise the capacity. And what is the, how do you figure out what our capacity is? How would you even, what metric are you using to determine the capacity?
Right.
That's a floating goalpost too. Right now in Alberta, at least, I've never seen the hospitals more quiet. I've never been slower on the ambulance. I worked today, not one call. The other night I did a shift where I responded to a guy who had just snorted crystal meth, fentanyl, cocaine, and GHB. And he gave me the sign of the cross and warded me away like I was a vampire, because he was scared I was going to give him the Rona. You know, he was more concerned about the coronavirus than he was about the fentanyl he just snorted. That's everyone right now. Everyone, like, you know, so on the one hand, I'm loving this in Canada, because our healthcare system is chronically overwhelmed. Like, it's overwhelmed every single day. The waiting rooms are busted. We're waiting in hospital hallways with patients in a healthcare line, just similar to a Soviet era bread line, waiting to offload for hours and hours. Sometimes I've been there past, you know, for 14 hours, waiting to offload my patient. That takes an ambulance off the streets that's not able to respond, that, you know, anyways, right now it's never been a better time. We've never had more healthcare abundance in Alberta, in the heart of this virus, this is... right? And, what they're saying, what they're using as their capacity line is the number of ventilators versus the number of expected. Well, that's one metric, I guess, but right. What about all the other things in healthcare, that we could, you know, so right now, if we were to take, if all the ICUs were full or overflowing on one metric, yes, the ICUs are way over capacity, but on another metric, the healthcare system has never had more capacity. So even the metrics that we're using, you know, don't tell the whole story. That's why they're having to go to things like one specific thing, like ventilators. That's the key thing. Even though most people who get put on a ventilator die anyways, like I think the survival rate's only 15 or 20%. So how are ventilators the panacea of healthcare capacity? There's just all sorts of craziness going on with this.
Well, this is interesting because I've seen some of the same things. I have friends who went to hospitals and, you know, they look like ghost towns. But is there, you know, and it suggested that, yeah, you know, if you get sick, you don't want to go to a hospital right now. There's probably a lot of people who are not doing elective surgeries and those sorts of things. But are there people who are going to be getting sick and they should be going to a hospital and they won't because they're afraid to? And is this going to, you know, maybe it's something where if they went early, it would be a fixable problem, but now they're going to die because they waited too long. What, like, could this potentially be creating, you know, like we were talking about earlier, it's saving some lives but costing others?
Yeah, I definitely think that could be the case. I mean, this guy that snorted fentanyl, for example, we eventually convinced him to let us assess him and take him to Emerge. You know, that guy needed to be monitored. I mean, fentanyl can kill you, but you know, but on the flip side, like, it's so hard to say in Canada here because we've become so dependent on it. You know, I usually see the waiting room full of people with stuck farts, weird pimples, hypochondria, just like minor ailments. Like, people just do not, you know, because they're not paying anything for this healthcare service, they just use it as a crutch to have the doctor run $3,000 worth of tests and tell them, yeah, and then they fart and everything's good. And, you know, like, they just wasted. So there's so much waste in the system that part of me is like, at least in Canada, I'm like, this is how, if you're going to have a universal healthcare system, this is how it probably should be utilized. You know, and it's finally not being as abused as it normally is, but certainly I could see that some people, you know, are like this fentanyl addict for sure. He wasn't able to triage risk properly, right? And right now, I think he's a perfect example of what we're seeing in society writ large, where people have elevated the risk of this virus to such a level that it trumps every other risk. There's a risk of just sitting on your couch and shutting down the economy. There's a risk of, you know, like this guy thought that the coronavirus was more risky than the fentanyl and the meth and everything else, all the drugs he just took. No, it's not. It's not more risky than that. Not
right.
You know, so what I worry about is someone feels a little bit of pain in their chest. And like you say, you know, I haven't dealt with one coronavirus patient yet but while this lockdown has been going on, I've been dealing with heart attacks and everything else. Well, how many people are scared to call or scared to go to the hospital? They feel a little bit of chest pain or feel a little bit of this, and they just try to ride it out because they don't want to take the risk of dying from coronavirus when that's right. A hard question. I don't know, but it could definitely be the case for sure.
Interesting. All right. Well, I kind of want to change the subject and maybe, talk about something less depressing. What other kind of things, I guess, is the Libertarian Party working for in Canada? What are some of the, I guess, top big issues, any progress that you're having, anything like that?
Yeah, I mean, it's a tough slog here in Canada. You know, liberty is not in our DNA. You know, well, the U.S. was formed when a bunch of libertarians killed a bunch of conservatives, formed a new country. You know, we stayed with the redcoats and, you know, have always loved big government ever since. You know, the conservative party here is probably more in line with the Democrat party down there. You know, we're very fairly left wing and we love our government. So it's a challenge. The way I look at it is, you know, I'm a big believer that government is downstream from culture and that chasing votes is less important than changing hearts and minds and persuading people and shifting the culture that way. And so, you know, I take a fairly radical approach here. You know, in the last election, we ran on ending the income tax and, you know, basically all the libertarian talking points all the way down, basically. Because people need to be connected with that radical message. They don't need to be soft-sold liberty right now. You know, less tax isn't as effective at communicating the philosophy of liberty as taxation is theft.
Right. You know?
And so I think it's real important. So to me, the metric of success isn't how many votes we get. It's how many libertarians did we make? And that has to be, in my mind, that's the only rational thing. That's the only pragmatic thing that can change government and create the kind of society we want to see. And so everything that we are doing under my leadership has to do with how do we connect people to that message? How do we change hearts and minds? And we have to be willing, unfortunately, to sacrifice votes to do that. You know, quite often, like people want us to party members want us to tone my message down or something like that. And I've tried all the different things. You know, I ran a fairly soft campaign in 2015, the first time I ran for prime minister. And because I didn't want to scare people away. And I just have come to realize that was wrongheaded, right? I was chasing votes rather than chasing hearts and minds. And, you know, in order to get votes, you have to water down your message. You have to soft sell it. You have to tell people what they want to hear. But that only gets you votes. That only helps you win elections. And what's the point in winning an election? The goal here isn't to win an election. It's to restrain government. The only thing that restrains it is culture. And so to me, this is a cultural movement. This is a cultural strategy. It's not. And so to me, I use a completely different metric than a traditional political party. It has all to do with creating libertarians and less to do with getting votes. And that's kind of the approach I take. Now, maybe I'm wrong. And if I am wrong, then what I should do is join the Conservative Party or the Liberal Party and just try to get into office and find my battle. But, you know, it's also very different here than it is in the U.S. because we couldn't have a Ron Paul in Canada, for example. I know there are some hardcore libertarians. In fact, there was a conservative MP who wore a taxation as theft t-shirt on a plane and got into crap for it. He had to downplay it, like say, oh, I just wore it as a joke, as a talking point, stimulate discussion. But I know that dude actually believes taxation is theft. He is probably a hardcore libertarian, but he can't say any of that stuff. He has to sit there and vote status quo right down the board. If he tried to pull a Ron Paul and vote no on something against his party or against his caucus, he would be kicked out of the party and he would not be back in office again. So you can't even be a Ron Paul here in Canada because you'll immediately lose your seat. You'll be on your own and you'll be out. And so if you're going to be a radical, and I think you have to be one to change hearts and minds, you have to join the Libertarian Party.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's so many different ways to look at it. I mean, if you don't change the culture and if you water it down and you get elected and then you try to pull some libertarian stunt, they're going to be like, what the hell is this? That's not what we voted for. Get out of here. We're not going to reelect you.
Exactly.
Yeah. So, yeah, it makes no sense to try to do it that way.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. And, you know, I've been watching this closely. This has always been a big debate in my mind and a big debate in my circles. And, you know, I've been leader of this party since 2014. So 6 years now, I guess. And, you know, I started out more as a pragmatist in that I was willing to say, you know, okay, we'll portray a platform that is halfway between where we're at now and minarchy. Right. So 15% flat tax rather than the 25% progressive tax we have now, or something like that. And just down the line, just a little bit more liberty in the next 4 years. And I'm not convinced anymore that that's the right way to go. You know, I watched with interest as Gary Johnson and Bill Weld were the faces of your party there in the last election. And, you know, I was genuinely interested to see if this would have any cultural effect, right? That's what I was looking for. And now they did great as far as I'm concerned in terms of votes. I thought they got, they were decent politicians, but I didn't see any more libertarians come out of that run for president than might've come out of, you know, someone else who was radical going out there and getting fewer votes, but actually creating more libertarians and creating more of a cultural impact. And so that to me solidified that, yeah, you know what, no more soft selling or any of this stuff or watering it down. I'm going to be sympathetic with the audience and understand this is a message that they're not used to or that they haven't heard before. I'm going to be empathetic and understanding and try to talk them through this in a gentle way and in a reasonable way and not come over the top and bash them over the head and call them libtards and statists and all these kinds of things that we libertarians are known for doing. We can be effective communicators with a radical message. I truly believe that. And I believe I've had some success with that, with respecting people and having a civil conversation with them and empathetically talking them through this stuff. But you have to tell them the truth about our philosophy. Right. You can't hide it under a bush or something like that.
Yeah, I've actually found, because I think we probably have a lot of similarities in how we got to where we are. But like I've had, you know, I've gone through cycles of you know, I'm kind of at the point now where I'm like, okay, how can we understand who these people are and why they're voting for things? And so in doing so, you know, you talk to like the you know, healthcare is a big one, because Bernie Sanders has these people sold on healthcare. Okay. Who doesn't want free healthcare? Who doesn't want to be healthy? Who doesn't want access to all this stuff? Like, that's not the fact that they're asking for government to give it to them is not the problem. That's just the one solution they've been given. They have real problems, which is they can't access healthcare. They can't afford it. And right. If you say like, okay, you can't access it and you can't afford it. Well, okay, socialism is one solution. Let me give you another solution. Instead of saying, no, that's wrong. That's wrong. Your solution is wrong. Let me remove the one solution that you have. Let me give you an alternative solution. And it's a libertarian solution. And when you just connect with people and be like, I get it. You have a problem. You have a sick grandmother and you want to make sure she's taken care of. Let's solve that problem a different way, then like people really respect that and they come to understand, oh wow, there are all these government programs that are in the way that are making the prices high. And you get to a point where like when you just have this conversation, an honest conversation with them, like they come to their own conclusion, yeah, so we should get rid of the FDA and we should get rid of this and we should get the government out of healthcare and all these other things. Yeah, and it's really amazing.
Yeah. And that's the approach I take too. Like healthcare, you know, they tell you on day one of your poli sci class, if you ever want to get elected in Canada, don't talk about healthcare, because Canadians, no matter what their, you know, what party they're affiliated with, will lynch you if you try to take away their healthcare. And that's why I approach it in terms of saying we need healthcare freedom here in Canada. We need to legalize healthcare. That's the way I frame it here. Not that we need to get rid of the public system, but that we just need freedom, right? And I tell them the stories about how my daughters should be able to provide healthcare without having to work for the government, and how much easier, you know, how much that would increase our capacity and this and that. You know, I can't pay for a blood test here in Canada to see what's in my blood. I should be able to see what's in my blood, but I have to go to a doctor. I have to wait, you know, in Fort McMurray at the time, I had to wait 3 months just to see my family doctor. And then he wouldn't even prescribe the blood test for me. And then when I go to the blood lab to see if I could just pay for it, they tell me no, that's illegal. So how am I supposed to see what's in my blood to get a hold of my health? I'm a paramedic. I know what I'm looking for. I was looking for my cholesterol levels, my C-reactive protein. I wanted to check inflammatory factors, and I wanted to have a test every week to see how my body was adjusting to a new diet and make sure I was on the right track and I was willing to pay for it. But that's illegal. But this is why we need to legalize healthcare, because I need to be able to get control, be in the driver's seat of my health, and be able to see what's going on with my body at the very least.
Right. That's you know? Interesting. I remember the last time I had to do a blood test in the U.S., I went, it was like a small family doctor, so they don't have their own in-house lab. They told me to go up the street to another lab, but I had to get like a prescription or certificate, but some sort of like,
whatever.
Yeah, an order of like what, you know, what I was supposed to get. And
yeah,
it's the same kind of thing. I don't know if it's illegal to walk in or if you can just ask for things, but down here in Mexico, well, so in the US it was, you know, expensive. Down here in Mexico, there's so many places you can just walk in and say, yeah, this is what I need. I want to check my vitamin levels. I want to check my cholesterol, like whatever it is. You just walk in. Yeah. You don't have to go see it, because like, think about it. Like if your doctor says just monitor your cholesterol and you say, okay, let me check my cholesterol once a month. And he tells you some numbers to look out for, make sure if it goes over this, come back and see me. If not, you're fine. If you're in the US or Canada and you have to go see a doctor every month, 12 times a year, there's a cost to that. There's now more doctors involved. They all have to get paid. That's all time. Yep. You're taking that time away from somebody else who might need to see them for something more important. And it's the system that's forcing that on top of itself. And I guess that's another way to look at that's limiting the capacity, not by, you know, the number of hours that the doctors and everybody else are providing are the same, but they're being wasted more than 1 hour of work by multiple people to accomplish the exact same thing.
Yeah.
That's an extra weight on the system.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
So awesome. Yeah. Well, we're coming up towards the end of the show. I want to give you an opportunity. If you want to plug anything, if anybody's interested I'm sure we actually have some viewers in Canada, because we've got, I've got the Taxationist Theft Shop and we've shipped stuff all over the world. But we have shipped a lot of stuff to Canada. So, if you want to give a plug, if somebody's interested, if they want to, help out the Libertarian Party, learn more, join, support,
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you can find our party page, libertarian.ca. If you're a Canadian citizen, you can send us some money. If not, you can't support us there. But, you know, you can check me out on Twitter at Moen_Tim or social media. I do have a podcast called The Liberty Experts. I do with another fellow Canadian who's an objectivist. And so we get into some interesting discussions there. I'm trying to slowly convert him into an anarcho-capitalist and point out all the flaws of objectivism, but we have some interesting debates and talks on there. So check out Liberty Experts, and I appreciate you having me on.
Absolutely. All right. Well, thanks again, and it's been really awesome. We'll have you again sometime, and I'll see you next time, guys. Taxation is theft.
Taxation is theft.
Please, at least leave us alone in our living room.
My job is to find the truth.
Double the taxes.
I'm a human being. God damn it. My life has value.
Triple the taxes.
This is an IRS agent's dream.
If you think that the Capitol will ever treat us fairly, you are lying to yourself.
Beautiful, lovely taxes.
Sorry, but I don't do taxes.
Did you see the memo about this?
The government is a greedy piglet.
Just leave us alone.
Do you know what Ralph just said?
The roads.